Murder and the quest for truth and justice are the subjects of crime fiction, but only Elliot Patterson sets his novels at the top of the world in Chinese-occupied Tibet. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Bones of the Earth is the 10th installment in the Inspector Shaun mystery series by author Elliot Patterson, whose interest in Tibet and the injustices brought upon the Tibetan culture and people over the past 60 years is the foundation of this series. And for mystery lovers, each one of these books is also in the best tradition of the genre. In the first novel, the Edgar Award-winning The Skull Mantra, we are introduced to Inspector Shan Taoyun, who has been imprisoned in Tibet in a Chinese prison for speaking too much truth in Beijing. There he encounters the Tibetan culture and is living amongst imprisoned monks. The ways of the monks transform Shan, and his abilities to observe and uncover truths drive the series. In this 10th installment, Shan is forced to witness an execution of a Tibetan, which leads him deep into a plot involving engineers, archaeologists, and an ancient shrine. Patterson fully immerses the reader into the colorful world of Tibet and the devastating and intentional destruction of a culture. Let's listen to our conversation. Elliot Patterson, we are here today to talk about your latest in the Inspector Shan series of mysteries called Bones of the Earth, and this is the 10th installment of that particular series. But before that, some of our listeners are probably eagerly awaiting this book and have been following you for years, and others, this might be their first introduction to you. So I'd like to kind of back us up a little bit, because I think you have an interesting background that has brought you into being a novelist. You had published several books of nonfiction as well. So why don't you share with us a little bit about your trajectory as an author and writer and how you moved into writing these fiction series?
I was extremely fortunate in my life to, over the last many years, to been able to do a lot of international travel, both for business and pleasure, really for decades. And I had logged 1,000,000 miles by the end of the 90s, and I stopped counting at that point. I saw an awful lot of the world, interacted with lots of cultures and people from all walks of life. I'm a lawyer by training, and I was doing a lot of international investment work, which took me to a lot of remote regions and meetings with a lot of government officials, including all the way up to ministers of state in various countries. Met with a lot of indigenous people in many, on basically every continent except Antarctica. I was, in the early years, I was what you would sort of broadly characterize as a Condé Nast traveler. You know, I was looking for the best hotel accommodations, the gourmet restaurants. But, you know, that began to wear out on me, and I realized that it was a real privilege to be able to have this opportunity to move around, and I was kind of wasting it by just circulating in Western-style accommodations and moved away from the glitz. So I began looking for more meaningful experiences. Whenever I traveled, I would push myself to take long walks, to travel to small villages, to look at the world and try to experience in terms of human achievements and natural wonders. You know, and I found that the world is a lot more interesting if you go out looking for miracles instead of four-star meals. Now, that's the broad introduction to where I was 20 years ago when I first started writing the Inspector Shaun series. And the reason I focused on Shaun was that I focused on this series was that I had, in looking for those miracles, I had experienced a lot of Asia. I had been a student of Asian religion for many years, dating back to college, but also beyond college. I was very interested in Tibetan Buddhism. I began experiencing Tibet in various ways, studying it and experiencing it firsthand, and really discovered that Tibet was one of those miracles. You know, here's a people who would live for millennia, and there's evidence now that they go back, there's human habitation going back at least 30,000, and some are saying now over 100,000 years up there, and what really is about the most inhospitable land, outside of the polar regions on the planet. And they develop this amazing spiritual tradition. They eschew technology. They have turned their back on technology in favor of compassion and development of the human spirit. And that meant over millennia, they developed this amazing culture, this really distinct culture that had unique systems of government, of religion, of education, of literature, of medicine. And it was really about the most different place on the planet you could experience. It was the closest. And I've read a lot of firsthand journals of travelers from the 19th century, and they pretty much experienced it as if they were going to a different planet because it was so extraordinarily different. And there were a lot of lessons for us, for all of the rest of the world in Tibet, in this country, that deliberately chose not to be materialistic, that deliberately chose not to have all this high technology, to live very simply and to focus on the human spirit and what happened to it. So it was one of the great, I believed, my view, somewhat informed view, that Tibet represented one of the great miracles of human civilization. And then what happened to Tibet in the last 50 years last 70 years now, really, was one of the great tragedies of human history, and you know, we can talk about that.
Yeah, you know, to me it is amazing that, and your books certainly reflect this, but that in just 70 years, the horrible attempts and destruction and the attempts to really break down that culture creates kind of a madness in a way when you think about the deep longevity of this culture and that in so short of time, there's this massive focus on breaking it down. And so in this place of Tibet, and for our readers and listeners, we're going to get into the books in just a minute, but I think it is important to talk about this, that there really is this clashing of the best of who we are as human beings and the worst of who we are.
Yeah, that's really well said. A lot of my readers didn't know anything about Tibet until they picked up my books, and we can talk about that. That's, you know, very satisfying to me that I was able to introduce them to Tibet. Very broadly, the recent history here is that China invaded Tibet in the 1950s while the rest of the world was occupied on recovering from World War II and occupied on the Korean War and the beginning of the Cold War, and nobody in the rest of the world was interested in picking a fight with China over Tibet. And they went in, and, you know, humanity, I really believe, lost an awful lot in these battles between mountain warriors with muskets and swords fighting machine guns and monks and lamas that were resisting with prayers while the Chinese army shelled them with artillery and bombed them with aerial bombs. And that itself is very poignant. And as you really very poignantly said yourself, there is a certain madness here. And there's a certain, I see Tibet as a certain lens that focuses what's been going on in the whole world. This is part of my message, that Tibet is not, it's a tragedy up at the top of the world, yes, but it really is a tragedy for all of us. And we need to realize that.
And so just about 20 years ago, then, you started writing this series of books with a focal character of Inspector Shaun and set it there in Tibet. So coming from the world of international travel and writing books of nonfiction, how did you make that leap into saying, I'm going to write a mystery series, but I'm going to place it in this place at the top of the world?
As you mentioned, I have been writing one thing or another ever since my college days, and a lot of nonfiction. I did technical books. I did a couple books on international business policy, a lot of articles and essays, and really, really wanted to try my hand at fiction. But by that time, I was very disturbed by Tibet and the way the world was ignoring that message, and felt like I felt compelled to get the message of Tibet out to a wider audience. And I had this epiphany that I could do both by, you know, trying to get a successful series that was set in Tibet. So that was the impetus for this. And it was a hard sell. A lot of just about I tried without an agent, and just about and every major publisher rejected it. And the first novel, The Skull Mantra, and the ones who even took time to reply to me said, why would you ever want to set a series in Tibet? Nobody's going to read it. But then I found the right agent and the right editor, and the book won the Edgar Prize for the best first novel, and Skull Mantra went into, and some of the subsequent books have gone into translations in 20 different languages around the world.
Well, you're a good storyteller, too.
I tried. Right?
That probably has something to do with it. But as you mentioned, you know, I think some people will pick up these books and have picked them up because they're avid mystery readers. And maybe this is their first introduction to this part of the world. And so I think probably for you as a writer, it's a delicate balance of creating compelling characters and a juicy enough mystery story filled with what readers like to see, but also this bit of cultural and spiritual realities that the characters inhabit. So maybe you had to do a little bit of a deep dive into that, but it seems like that would be a tricky balance.
You know, a lot of people, and I know you have a very, you know, literary audience who can relate to this, a lot of people sort of set mysteries in a different niche. And traditionally, a lot of people that have kind of looked down on mysteries, it's sort of, you know, cozies and the Marlowe books and the tough detective guys. But mysteries, I wanted to try my hand at the mystery, but as I said, to get this Tibetan message in there. And I was beginning to perceive, and I think it's been proven by experience, that mysteries have really expanded. And, you know, there are a lot of good literary mystery writers out there now. And, you know, that's kind of my genre, you know, in terms of when I get labels, I'm labeled more as a literary mystery writer than anything. But it is a real challenge, okay? And one of the, you know, there's a great quotation that really epitomizes a lot about what's going on in Tibet, and that was by the Jesuit scholar Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who said that, you know, we are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. That sums up Tibet, I mean, in spades. And to get that message across, to get people to understand, to live that, it has to be fiction, okay? There are a lot of chronicles about Tibet that are just firsthand journals, diaries, commentaries, essays. They're very good, but they're very dry and they're sterile and they read like history books. And, you know, how do you get a reader to really experience this tragedy and understand this terrible tension, you know, often violent tension between the spiritual and simply, you know, the non-spiritual, but really the materialistic, militaristic, government that's trying to destroy that spiritual culture. And that's, you can only do that with fiction. I really believe that. And only a special kind of fiction can achieve that. And so that's been my goal to get there.
And in your very first book, you start out the whole genesis of this character, Sean. It begins in a prison. and in hard labor. And so right there, we're brought into this conflict of culture and cultural values right there. But then you also have this mystical quality in talking about spirits and demons and using that kind of language that is the language of fiction. But weaving it in that way does help color the story and elevate it in a way beyond just, as you say, something dry and historical, but something that is kind of filled with some mysticism and unknown for us.
And that's all part of the Tibetan story. So a lot of people say, why would you have a Chinese protagonist, you know, for a series set in Tibet? The simple answer was that the readers then could experience Tibet as Sean, my protagonist, learns about Tibet. So if I had a Tibetan monk as my protagonist, he would already know all this stuff, and it wouldn't be the same sense of discovery and revelation and epiphany that goes on with Sean all the time. There's that aspect, but then and setting it, starting in the gulag prisons of Tibet, was a way of really, you know, very abjectly introducing the reader into the reality of the persecution that goes on in Tibet. But then, as you know, to your point, more specifically, Tibet has this incredibly complex cosmology, this really complex system of beliefs that's the result of an old animistic religion, the Bon religion of traditional Tibet, merging, being integrated with Buddhism that came up from India a few centuries ago. And so, you know, it gets very complicated, and I weave those in. I want my readers, if I'm really successful, I get my readers to feel that the tragedy, but also to be really interested in that really complex and really unique belief system that the Tibetans have.
And that the character, Sean, is himself kind of moving through. And there are other characters, too, that move along in the series of these 10 books as well, who we see how they face kind of the conundrum of their situation, and especially those who are involved in the Chinese dominant culture over trying to change these people of Tibet.
I very much, very deliberately have a theme that focuses on the effect of oppression on the oppressor. And there's all, which I think is very, you know, very real. And you know, to put it real simply, in current day terms, a lot of people are reading about the million Uyghurs, the Muslim population up north of Tibet that are in prison today, that are in internment camps. And there are, what people don't know is that there is about 1 million Chinese government workers that are required to maintain those million in prison. And so from my perspective, there's 2 million victims.
Yes.
Okay, and I know I don't mean to minimize the plight of the prisoners, but you know, this being the oppressor and running these prisons in various roles sucks everything spiritual out of you. And the Chinese people overall, you know, I really am firmly of the belief that the average Chinese person does not like what its government has done in Tibet or in Xinjiang with the Uyghurs, but they can't protest. The government doesn't, you know, make it possible. And, you know, the Chinese tradition, you know, through the centuries is one of great compassion, and is one of, also has a theme of spirituality that's, you know, parallel to the Tibetan themes. And, you know, there's another set of victims. There's another price that's paid for this oppression, you know, that this wonderful Chinese culture has been destroyed, as well as the Tibetan culture.
Yes. When they talk about destruction, they mean it. And we've seen that in other places in the world, too. But, I mean, wiping out buildings, places, and
I don't think, and I've had some arguments with my editors sometimes about this, because I've made some very strong statements about, you know, to the effect that there's never in the history of mankind been such a deliberate, systematic, widespread effort to destroy a culture as in Tibet. And I really believe that. And I've had pushback, people saying, well, that's kind of extreme. But if you look at the numbers, okay, I mean, there were, first of all, a million. When the Chinese invaded, there were between five, and the best estimates are there were between 5 and 6 million Tibetans. Over a million died resisting the Chinese. They devastated, well over 90% of all the thousands of temples and sanctuaries and monasteries and convents. There were, every family used to have a monk in its family. The first son would go off to be a monk, typically, or the first daughter would go off to be a nun. Today, all the monks have to be registered with the government. They have to take loyalty oaths. They have to disavow the allegiance to the Dalai Lama. Their license. They have, some of them are taking life, forced to take lie detector tests to test their loyalty. Now, there's only 5% of the monks today versus the number that existed in 1959. At the height of the occupation, the invasion. It's staggering. People don't understand how awful it is. I mean, what's one thing the government's done is to equate what they call the aggressive practice of Buddhism, which really means, if you have a picture of the Dalai Lama in your house, that's aggressive practice of Buddhism, and that's, they equate that to terrorism. They absolutely do. It sounds bizarre, but they do. And so they feel, therefore, they can do whatever they want with terrorists. There's been about over 150 self-immolations in Tibet to protest the government in the last decade. And those are just awful. I mean, words can't describe how terrible that is. The government treats self-immolation as an act of terror. And anybody who helped, and the family of the victim of the self-immolation, are characterized as terrorists. And they're generally put away. And that's how the government discourages self-immolation. In the last year, they're beginning to, where people had the photograph of the Dalai Lama, they're requiring to put photograph on their altars, photographs of President Xi, the president of China. And to bow to the president, like they used to bow to the portrait of the Dalai Lama. I mean, these are just, I could go on and on. I mean, it's just devastating. They have a huge bureaucracy around essentially destroying artifacts and the material culture of the Buddhist religion. So anything that is Buddhist related, any artifacts, books, et cetera, all the icons, all the figurines on altars, they're the property of the state. And the state can do what it wants with them, and typically they destroy them. So the vast majority of those kind of artifacts and icons have been destroyed by the government. Children are forced to speak Chinese in schools, and they get Chinese names assigned to them, and they grow up speaking Chinese. A lot of them go to boarding schools, and when they come back home, they can speak Chinese better than Tibetan. And they say they have these Chinese names, and their parents are like, don't speak Chinese. So you can imagine how awful that is. I mean, there's so many aspects and so many dimensions to the horror of this what essentially is a cultural genocide that's going on.
And just what you were describing about sending children away to school to learn a different language than their own, I think of our own country and our own legacy with Native Americans. And it seems like you're other series of books might address some of that. So you have another series of books, and we are going to get to the Bones of the Earth, and I want to talk more about Inspector Sean, but you do have another series of books with another protagonist, and it's set in America. Why don't you tell us a little bit, just quickly, about that series, because sure, some of our readers might not be familiar with that.
So the initial book in that series was Bone Rattler, and it's the Bone Rattler series, and I'm just finishing up the sixth installment of the Bone Rattler series. That book is set, and that series begins in the French and Indian War, and it's progressing somewhat rapidly towards the Revolutionary War. So the latest one is set in 1769, 1770 America, and a little bit of it in England as well. A lot of people say, why would you write something so different? How could you possibly move from contemporary Tibet to 18th century America? And my answer would be somewhat complex if I gave the full story, but I don't see that I don't see too many differences, okay? Because I write about abandoned peoples, about people who have to get justice outside the normal system because their government, you know, is persecuting them and their government will not provide justice. And there are a lot of, you know, essentially what you might call exiles and orphans in my books, in both series. And in the Bone Rattler series, my protagonist is a, you might call it an exiled Highlander, Highland Scott. And he has been condemned unfairly by the British government. And instead of being condemned to prison, he was condemned to indentured servitude in America. He's thrust into the New York wilderness through a series of events. Terry's first terrified of the Native Americans, and then he's forced to live with the Native Americans, essentially, and he begins to realize the incredible sort of spiritual culture that they have. So, you know, the Native Americans in my books, which are mostly Iroquois, are the Tibetans of the Shan series. And they're the, you know, sort of the people with the very exotic, esoteric culture being experienced by the Westerner, you know, who himself is kind of an exile and has a lot of himself has really been persecuted by his government. And so they're all in this path together of trying to maintain human values and spirituality, just like Sean is in the Sean series.
Well, I'm anxious to take a look at that series myself. I think that our own history of colonization and westward migration and the devastation that has happened to Native peoples in our country is something I think we generally, people have a very superficial knowledge of that very poignant history of our country that still is with us today, but we have not really faced it. And so I'm curious to see how you approach it in these books.
My books very, you know, that series very heavily feature Native Americans, and they're very authentic. And we can talk about this. I mean, I take great lengths in both series to be very, very authentic. You know, the background, all the setting, the color to the books, as it were, is very, very factually oriented, and I really labor to make sure it is. You know, that's genuine and authentic. I believe it's very authentic to say that the Native Americans of the frontier had a very profound influence on the colonists. And I don't mean just because they, you know, in the traditional views, they attacked them and killed them. That's just one small piece of the interface. That certainly didn't happen everywhere. There are a lot of examples of you know, very peaceful relations and a lot of coexistence, a lot of learning back and forth. And I focus on that. You know, there are things, for example, my Highland Scots have a great affinity for the Iroquois in my books. And I was building that up in the first, as I was writing the first book, because I thought it felt very natural. And then I, in my research, and I'm always doing research, I found accounts that were to me very, were just wonderful, of the first Highland troops that arrived in Albany in the 1750s. And the Iroquois, who were allies of the British at the time, had never liked the army very much, and they were sort of very skeptical about the army, but they coexisted with the army. And the Scots came in, and when the Scots were marching through, the Highlanders in their kilts, the Iroquois stared at them and began shouting out, "Brothers!" And some of them ran over and embraced the Highlanders. And they just, there was some little bond there that was very, you know, very ethereal. They didn't speak a common language at the time, and, you know, but they still recognized this. And I think, you know, it was a culture that was very, both cultures, Highland and the Iroquois, very heavily based in nature and very, and you could say militaristic as part of it, or, you know, warrior culture, but sort of a wild, you know, a certain wildness was also important in both cultures. And so I explore an awful lot of that. And also the role of nature in freedom. And that's kind of a loaded phrase, but I believe that the colonists discovered a sort of a new sense of freedom and a new definition of freedom compared to what was known in Europe. And a lot of that had to do with the American wilderness and the American nature, and also seeing how the natives had created a culture around nature. You know, a lot of learnings there, just like the Tibetans have a lot of learnings for us. So I do a lot of exploring of that. We can talk in more detail sometime about all that.
I was going to say we're going to have you back to talk about that series of books. So that's the Bone Rattler series, and you have five books in that series?
Five books out, and the sixth will be out next spring.
All right.
I am talking with Elliot Pattison, and his latest book in the Inspector Sean series is Bones of the Earth. Let's take a short break.
Where are we? What the hell is going on? The dust has only just begun to fall. Crop circles in the carpet, sinking feeling. Spin me round again and rub my eyes. This can't be happening when busy streets amiss with people would stop to hold their heads heavy.
Was Imogen Heap with Songs of Tibet from The Art of Peace. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Let's return to my conversation with Elliot Pattison. We came together to talk about the 10th installment in his Inspector Sean mystery series, Bones of the Earth. We were enjoying a ranging conversation, and I thought it was time to bring us back to his most recent novel.
The current book we're here to talk about is Bones of the Earth, and it is the 10th of this Inspector Sean series that began with the Skull Mantra. And in this book, we find Inspector Sean again having to go deep, and literally deep in the ground and deep in the earth, to uncover the dastardly plot of some of the Chinese. I don't know, would they be the military
Chinese government? It's hard to distinguish military from some of the other agencies because they're all very militaristic. He finds himself confronted by very broadly the Beijing's economic engine, that's devastating the landscape and trying to get economic benefit for the Chinese people out of Tibet. The Chinese name historically for Tibet translates as the Western storehouse. And they still treat it that way. It's like this massive region, and Tibet makes up nearly a third of traditional Tibet makes up nearly a third of the current Chinese landmass, and so it's a massive, massive region, and it's full of resources that Eastern China does not have: forest and minerals and lakes and all the major rivers. I think maybe one exception, but the major rivers of Asia all start in Tibet, all start up in the Tibetan highlands. And there are a lot of lakes, a lot of dams, many, many rivers. And so Sean is confronting a group that are responsible for building and damming up a sacred valley. And so they sort of become the villains, but it's not hard. It's not a stretch in terms of fact or fiction. I mean, there are a lot of these events going on, and there are a lot of sacred valleys, in Tibet. The Tibetan people have the animistic aspects of Tibetan Buddhism feature an awful lot of land, deities or earth gods, that's why, left on their own, there wasn't any, environmental devastation in Tibet, because the land was always sacred to them. Just like the Native Americans, the land was sacred. And then here come the Chinese, and the land's not sacred. What's sacred to them is getting monetizing resources. And so, in my book, but it's also very factually based, they're destroying this valley with all kinds of sacred histories. In the valley, and I wrapped the mystery, and they're sort of devious about how they're going about it, and there's been some crimes committed to accelerate the progress of their project, and Tibetans want to stop it, and China's facing a series of murders, and it kind of all comes together in terms of solving the murders and resolving the development of the Sacred Valley, and basically stopping that by what Sean does. It all fits together.
I find him interesting in that he doesn't seem like he talks a lot. It seems like he's a thoughtful person who has his own spiritual evolution, and he is open to things he doesn't know. But he seems to me to be the calm, whether he is or not, but he seems that he can be calm and observing as he watches and observes what's going on all sides around him. He just seems to pay attention.
Yeah. I mentioned Chinese culture earlier, and that culture has whether it's Confucianism or Taoism has a lot of contemplation, you know, a lot of quietness and philosophical musings on you know, the human condition. And Sean was brought up with that, even somewhat secretly, because by the time he was growing up, the communists were already trying to destroy those systems. And I have a lot of experience with Chinese families that have done this. They secretly are keeping those traditions alive, even though they know the Chinese government would punish them if it was known. And so he came from that tradition. He became sort of a star. He sort of rode the juggernaut of the Chinese government. It became a sort of high level esteemed detective in Beijing. But then started accusing the wrong government officials in Beijing, of massive corruption, and so they decided to eliminate him by sending him off to the Chinese, to the Tibetan Gulag, and thinking he would die because there are a lot of prisons that have huge death rates in Tibet, and instead he's saved, as he reflects many times in the various books. He was essentially saved and reincarnated, he likes to say, by the Tibetans in the prison, where he was in prison with a lot of Tibetan monks and lamas. And so he has that, back to your point, he has that sort of contemplative, quiet demeanor from his Chinese upbringing. But, of course, the Tibetan culture, Tibetan spirituality that he absorbs also has a lot of those elements as well. So, yes, he doesn't engage in a lot of small talk, right? He tries to, see through things and understand motivations and understand, the philosophical or even the spiritual motivations. And most of my mysteries never can be fully solved without understanding the spiritual or, if you want, philosophical aspects and motives behind the actions.
And he always seems to have a handful of incense in his pocket.
Well, it's very common, right? Because that's the way you showed respect for the deities and attracted the deities. Like if you're as part of the animistic aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, you actually have that in a lot of Native American cultures too. Burning fragrant tobacco and stuff, yes, to attract the spirits. And so he would have that. A lot of Tibetans would carry incense around that way. And when they get to altars or to a sacred boulder or whatever, that they consider sacred, they would light it to show respect.
And he always gets pulled back into this solving of murders or...
One of his burden is that, although he was, reincarnated essentially, in Tibet and has become a Tibetan Buddhist in many ways, the only way he can keep his freedom, and it gets more complicated as the series progresses, it winds up also to protect his son. The only way he can do all this and stay employed and have a livelihood and a home is to work as a policeman. He's been sort of forced to do that by the ruthless governor of the county that he lives in, who is one of these oppressors that has become a great victim of a very tragic victim of all the oppression, and he evolves himself a lot in the process. But Sean is forced to be a policeman in order to maintain his freedom, which is very ironic. And so he's a reluctant investigator in an official sense, but he is driven by his feelings for the Tibetans to help them solve their mysteries anyway. And so it's always, he always has this dilemma of official justice versus unofficial justice. And official justice often winds up being very unfair. And so, how much trouble will he get in by dropping official justice to affect unofficial justice? That's always a dimension in these books.
You have some pretty incredible descriptions of the landscape and the little town that he's the constable of, and underground chambers and passageways. And
Tibet's a very big place, and although Lhasa and Shigatse and the major cities have become predominantly Chinese, through massive Chinese immigration, a lot of it forced. There are many, you know, distant, remote villages and towns that are still very traditional Tibet. You know, they're very impoverished and a very simple way of life, and you know, not a very, you know, high standard of living at all. And then another aspect is that almost all of those villages and towns were built around monasteries, you know, or big Buddhist seminaries even. And the Chinese destroyed them, but the destruction wasn't always complete. And so there are indeed a lot of ruins of monasteries, convents, temples that still have chambers here and there, usually underground, that are still intact. And when the government finds out about them, they try to destroy them. But of course, nobody wants to tell the government about them. And so Sean, even though he's a government official, he does everything he can to help hide these chambers, which are the underground chapels of a major monastery that existed in his village.
And there are, I mean, the story opens with there's a murder by the people building this dam and wanting to flood the valley. They kind of blow up to close off a cave that was discovered to have all these incredible murals on the walls and to be this sacred place that the person who discovered it thought it could be a World Heritage Site and that it was a great significant discovery. And just your describing of that and the deep history, the pre-Buddhist history, and that there was also a cross maybe painted there to indicate that this location was a place for all people and a great spiritual place.
I mentioned, I think I've read, you know, early chronicles of travelers into Tibet, and I really, these are fascinating to me, and a number of travelers, the very earliest travelers were Western missionaries, and they were Jesuits that went into Tibet centuries ago, and there was a specific Jesuit priest that I mentioned who was taken around to religious sites in China in the early 1700s, and he left a few crosses here and there, but he wasn't trying to convert. He was really sort of a scholar, and you know, there was never any massive effort to convert the Tibetan Buddhists. Usually what happens is that, and there's been, you know, there were quite a few chronicles like this and experiences of Western travelers, mostly European travelers, who came out of Tibet very profoundly transformed. And, you know, their stories are quite interesting as well. I sometimes, in some of the books, I weave some of those early tales into the plots.
Well, for our readers and listeners today, Bones of the Earth is the 10th installment in the Inspector Shan mystery series. And if you are familiar with these books, you're going to love them. And if you have not been introduced to them, it seems like they stand on their own, but it might be more fun to start at the beginning with the Skull Mantra.
Yeah, they're intended to stand on their own, but they would make, you know, reading the Skull Mantra first would help set the stage for understanding Sean better.
Yeah, and I think, when readers engage with these kind of series where you're following somebody, you know, through them, sometimes it's kind of fun to get to know the ancillary characters as well and when they reoccur and that sort of thing. But these books have, as we've been talking about today, have a lot more to offer and are stimulating on a lot of different levels and satisfying on those levels we like. And I just want to ask you one more question because we're rapidly running out of time. All the material says this is the last of the Inspector Shan series. And so why are you saying that when it doesn't seem like it?
Well, my publisher and I both thought that it was enough for now. I'd rather say it that way.
Okay.
And what's happening is I'm already developing another series that's built out of the Shan series. And hope to have that out in the next couple of years, involved, more set in the West, but with a Tibetan monk, a young Tibetan monk, who actually is helping the main American character in Bones of the Earth, and he, and that former FBI agent becomes the main character of this new series. And I am not precluding more Sean novels in the future. We just don't have any right now. You know, I'm developing.
Well, Elliot Pattison, so glad you were able to join us today, and we look forward to more reading with you.
Great pleasure, Suzanne. I appreciate it, and glad to chat again in the future.
Okay. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
I have been talking with Elliot Pattison on Tibet, his body of work, and his latest release, the 10th in his Inspector Sean mystery series, Bones of the Earth. I thank you for listening today. Subscribe to our podcasts at norcalpublicmedia.org. Follow the radio and podcast links. I have had production assistance from Anthony Garcia, Sean Knight, and Mark Prell. Just a quick reminder, part of listening to public, community-supported radio is to become a supporter yourself, a sponsor, a contributor. Visit our website and click on the button that says Donate. I am Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea. Hey, I'm Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. I hope you have subscribed to our podcast where you can listen to past shows. But right now I want to tell you about some books that have come to me that may be of interest to you. Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, a memoir by NPR correspondent Yarti Namdev Shahani, on her immigrant experience that took a turn when her father accidentally became involved in the Cali drug cartel. That's Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. Neil Rechtman has just come out with a novel of the Supreme Court, The Ashwander Rules, a novel set with a fictional Supreme Court, but it's really all about the importance of judicial restraint, especially as it relates to the questions of constitutional law, the Ashwander Rules. In his follow-up to his first Obama-Biden mystery, Hope Never Dies, Andrew Schaffer has just published Hope Rides Again, featuring our favorite crime-fighting heroes Barack Obama and Joe Biden. His first book was a fun homage, and this looks to be the same, a lens into our popular culture. Hope Rides Again. Jonah Raskin's follow-up to his first novel, which was the eco-noir Dark Land, Dark Mirror, is a marijuana murder mystery, Dark Day, Dark Night. Jonah has fun with the forum and with creating a fictional Sonoma that we recognize bits of, but hopefully not the murders. And lastly, I want to mention The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future, by Carlos Moreira and David Ferguson. They ask some important questions about our relationship with technology and whether we are centralizing technology at the expense of humanity. The Transhuman Code aims to center humanity in the emerging tension between a human-controlled and a machine-controlled world. That's The Transhuman Code. These are just a few books I wanted to bring to your attention and have you think about and maybe pick up and read. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.